Okay, thanks very much. I just want to start by introducing you. So Jess Myers earned a bachelor's degree in computer science from George Mason University. She then worked at Northrop Grumman as a software and systems engineer, as well as a project manager in areas including cybersecurity. In fall 2018, she began law school at Santa Clara University, where she is now completing her second year of studies. And at Santa Clara, she is also the founder and president of the Santa Clara Law Internet Law Student Organization. She has been a TEDx speaker at Santa Clara Law on the challenges of content moderation on the internet. And in summer 2020, she will be performing research at the UCLA Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy. So thank you very much, Jess, for spending some time talking to us about artificial intelligence, the First Amendment, and the information ecosystem.
Absolutely. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to chat.
Okay, so I'm going to start, just go right into the questions here. So the first question is that one of the freedoms conferred by the First Amendment is, of course, that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And of course, that means that the First Amendment constrains government, but not private companies such as Twitter, Facebook, Yelp, YouTube, and so on. Yet in discussions about user-posted content on these and other sites, the First Amendment often comes up, often brought up by the companies themselves. Can you explain a bit why freedom of expression is such a core part of the conversation regarding content moderation, particularly given the internet that internet companies are not under any constitutional obligation to provide it?
Yeah, so this is a really important question. I'm glad this is the first question because it kind of tees everything up here. So the way I see it, there are two kind of camps when it comes to the First Amendment's role in online content moderation. So you've got the first camp, which is that the internet companies and their right to have, what we refer to as editorial discretion. And on the other side, we have people who equate this quote-unquote editorial discretion with censorship. And these are usually the folks who often get upset with an internet service, like Twitter, for example, when they remove your content or your speech, or even when they block your ability to continue contributing to the online conversation. So distinguishing between editorial discretion and censorship is a really crucial part of the First Amendment debate. So it's important to remember that our constitutional rights, like the First Amendment's freedom of speech, really only goes as far as restricting government from infringement. So when we're talking about censorship, we're really only talking about instances when the government or a state actor held out by the government, restricts or curbs our speech in some way. Notably, though, internet services are not the government and they're not state actors held out by the government. So we as users technically have no real speech rights in using those services. So kind of hence that's why when an internet service makes a decision to restrict content, they're doing so in their editorial capacity. That's that editorial discretion. And we see that editorial discretion kind of come up like in traditional print media, like newspapers. Newspapers have the right to control their own press. Internet companies too enjoy those freedoms when it comes to moderating their content on their services. And if the government were to start regulating these content moderation decisions, then they would be violating the services' own First Amendment rights to their editorial discretion. Now, importantly, these services need their editorial discretion arguably more than traditional print media simply because of the massive amounts of user-generated content they encounter and must deal with on a regular basis, very different from what a newspaper would have to deal with. So that's why the First Amendment is constantly kind of a core part of this discussion.
Okay. Do you want to, maybe it helps for some of the people watching this may not be familiar with CDA 230, and maybe it's an unfair question to ask you to explain it in, 2 or 3 minutes, but could you give a brief primer on kind of why do we have, where did it come from, and what role does it play, and why is it such a big topic when it comes to, content moderation and discussion of how platforms should handle content?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act essentially says that websites are not responsible for third-party content. So for example, if I were to post something defamatory about you on Twitter or Facebook, Section 230 would shield Facebook or Twitter from liability from that post. Now, there are some exceptions for federal criminal law. So anything that, you know, the DOJ could prosecute, that would be outside of the scope of Section 230's protection. So child pornography, for example. And we also have our intellectual property infringement as well, also not within Section 230's scope. But importantly, Section 230 also shields services from liability from for their own content moderation decisions as well. So if a site decides to take down what we kind of call lawful but awful content, or even if a site decides to ban a user entirely from their service, Section 230 will protect that decision. So there are two, you can't talk about Section 230 unless you talk about kind of its history a little bit and the two cases from the 90s that tee it up. So there's two really important cases. The first one involves a famous internet access service provider called CompuServe. CompuServe sold internet connectivity and internet services, just a little bit of both. I almost sometimes equate it to AOL for those that, you know, wouldn't be familiar with CompuServe necessarily. Well, one of the forums on that CompuServe hosted, they had a daily newsletter, ironically called the Rumorville. And you can probably guess, you know, it's obvious what happened from there. Somebody posted something to Rumorville and it was defamatory and CompuServe was sued for it. So interestingly, the court ended up holding that CompuServe was not liable for the defamatory postings. And that was because CompuServe took a very hands-off approach to moderating their content. They said, you know what, we're not going to moderate. We're not going to touch. We're not going to, you know, see the content, know about the content. And so the courts actually said, cool. There's no way CompuServe could have known about that defamatory post, so they're not liable. Fast forward, we have this very similar second case involving one of CompuServe's competitors called Prodigy. It's the same idea, almost the same fact pattern. Something defamatory is posted on a Prodigy web forum, but the result is concerningly different. So the court in Prodigy decides, well, Prodigy was liable for the postings. And that's because Prodigy, unlike CompuServe, would moderate their service heavily because they wanted a more family-friendly environment, family-friendly service. So the courts actually looked at that and said, okay, well, then there were ways in which you could have known about this defamatory posting because you do have a hand in your moderation process, so you're liable for it. Those two cases kind of teed up what we call today a moderator's dilemma. At that time. So, you know, internet services were kind of torn. You know, they could either take the CompuServe approach and not moderate anything, and, you know, they're not liable. But think about what that would mean today if your Facebook or Twitter or, you know, any of these internet services didn't moderate content. Or they could take the other approach, which would be family friendly, but knowing that they would be liable for any content that slipped through the cracks. And so to put that in a more modern view, that would be the idea of if, you know, Twitter pre-reviewed every tweet before it went out. You can imagine how that would change the internet ecosystem dramatically. Well, Congress kind of recognized that that was problematic, this dilemma. And so, you know, hence Section 230 was born, kind of get the best of both worlds here between the two. You can decide to moderate your service as you see fit. So that's kind of the, I guess, the rundown of Section 230's history and how Section 230 works. You know, there's an interesting conversation to be had in that, you know, I just got done telling you that the First Amendment is supposed to protect the internet services. So, you know, what value add is Section 230? And you know, we can talk about that. There's a lot of reasons why Section 230 is better than the First Amendment in many regards.
Well, yeah, I'd love to hear that. What are your thoughts on that?
Sure. So, you know, again, what does Section 230 add to all this? Well, so in actuality, Section 230 is a lot stronger than the First Amendment. For starters, again, let's think back to the traditional print media. So, you know, the First Amendment doesn't protect a newspaper from a defamation lawsuit necessarily, and that the same way that Section 230 protects websites. And that has a lot to do with the amount of control that newspapers can exhibit over, you know, information dissemination versus websites, right? So newspapers can pick and choose, you know, what articles they run, whereas with internet services, it's a free-for-all. And so that's why Section 230 needs to apply to these internet services. It's why they can't be held liable in the same way that newspapers and print media can be held liable, because they're dealing with a massive scope of content that they don't have control over. But you know, there's other reasons why Section 230 is stronger, and one of those is Section 230's inherent predictability. So lawsuits are really, really, really expensive and really time consuming. And so Section 230 kind of gives this necessary confidence back to internet services to create and enter the marketplace without this fear, this looming fear of possibly being sued. The First Amendment doesn't really have that guarantee. You know, you'll probably likely win on a First Amendment defense. But, you know, our role as, you know, lawyers is to keep our clients out of the courtroom. And Section 230 gives us that confidence that we won't be in constant court battles. So that's actually why Section 230 is kind of credited with creating the internet. Because without it, we wouldn't have most of the services that we rely on so heavily today, especially today. And I will say, if you're interested in deep diving more about the Section 230 First Amendment, you know, how they play against each other, I highly recommend reading a paper written by Section 230 expert and my advisor at Santa Clara Law, Professor Eric Goldman. He entitled "Why Section 230 is Better than the First Amendment."
Oh, thank you very much. Okay, so here's the next question: is how has the climate regarding Section 230 or CDA 230 changed in the last year or two? And my impression is that there's been increasing pressure both from the political left and from the political right to weaken CDA 230. And what spurred that dialogue to occur? And what are some of the arguments in favor of weakening 230 and some of the rebuttals to that, to those arguments?
Yeah, so Congress, I would say, and some of the internet's users as well, have sort of fallen out of love with the internet. Now perhaps that sentiment has changed in light of recent unfortunate events. But for the most part, the current bipartisan animosity towards Section 230 is largely due to this burnt out attitude about the online world. So, you know, in some ways I can't blame people who feel that way about the internet. Between fake news and misinformation, 2016 election, you know, concerns about sex trafficking, the opioid crisis. I mean, we can go on for days. You know, this general distaste towards big tech is not surprising. Especially this hatred towards what people refer to as, you know, big tech's quote unquote gift that is Section 230. So kind of to lay out the political battlefield here for 230. So Democrats typically disfavor Section 230 because they, again, mistakenly believe that it's a gift that the tech companies abuse to shield themselves from all liability without any responsibility. So this stems from this whole sword and shield idea that Section 230 is supposed to embody, and the drafters kind of envisioned when they enacted the law. So the whole idea is that Section 230 is a sword for eliminating bad content, but also a shield for protecting those moderation decisions if they eliminate that content. Democrats typically think that tech companies only rely on the shield without utilizing the sword. And we saw this when we were talking about, you know, when they were fighting, you know, for sex trafficking victims or for children and their online safety, or even, you know, against misinformation, especially with regard to our election. So Democrats just want to see internet services do more. On the flip side, you've got the Republicans, and they typically believe that tech companies rely too heavily on the sword, you know, to censor, as they call it, conservative speech. So, you know, Ted Cruz, for example, is infamous for his messaging about how Section 230 requires tech companies to maintain neutral public forums. Of course, you know, from our discussion about the First Amendment, this is obviously very incorrect. But there is, you know, there's never been any real concrete evidence that's come out that tech companies are biased against conservatives. But even if there were, like, even if there was evidence, it really wouldn't matter, because as private companies, they are free to moderate content as they deem fit or as they see as appropriate. And you know, I'm sorry to say this, but sometimes for, you know, that specific group, for sometimes their rhetoric, you know, maybe it's graphic messaging about abortion or more of those sensitive topics, those tend to be the topics that services deem inappropriate for their users. And so that's why you see this backlash from the conservative side. You know, regardless, Section 230 is not, in my opinion, the cause of the internet's awfulness. It's the solution to this. Awful content has been around on the internet, you know, since before Section 230. But what's changed is now services have the necessary tooling available, you know, through AI to combat a lot of this awful content. And they're encouraged to experiment now with ways in which to combat that content because of Section 230. And because Section 230 affords them the necessary protections to do that. Importantly, you know, Section 230 is not a gift to the tech company, to big tech. It's a necessary immunity that continues to allow these internet services to thrive and to exist in its current form. And I think we often forget that the internet is not solely Facebook and Google and Twitter. There are so many small internet services and potential market competitors that rely heavily on Section 230 to even exist in the marketplace alone. And to them, Section 230 is not a gift, it's a lifeline. The last major argument that I hear against 230 is that it's an outdated law. That's, you know, it was drafted in 1996, and it was drafted for the internet's problems of the 90s. And thus it's in need of an update or amendment for the modern internet. And I disagree with that. I think people that make that argument are assuming that we're at the end game, we're at the internet's end game, and that there's no more that we can be doing with the internet. And to assume that would, I think, is ridiculous. I think we're always innovating, and I think Section 230 is what opens the doors to those innovations. So if you're willing to believe that the internet is done and this is it, then, you know, sure, maybe there is time for regulation, but I don't think this is the end game here.
Okay, well, thank you. So here's a question about international content. So given that major internet companies and less major ones operate internationally, how should they respond to pressure from governments that might want them to take down content, for example, such as criticism of a political leader that might be perfectly lawful to engage in that criticism in the United States, but that might violate laws in another country? How should they respond to these sorts of political pressures for censorship that would never fly in the American context, especially if that censorship then comes with the threat of being blocked from servicing that country? I mean, this is a hard question, but just
no.
General thoughts would be welcomed.
Yeah, no, this is a super difficult question. I ran into this a lot when I was working at Twitter. This is probably one of the hardest issues that these internet services run into daily. This was constantly an issue that I had seen come up in my internship. You know, so I've heard there's so many different sides to this, and the one that I've kind of heard a majority of internet services kind of talk about is you could take the American central view, right? And so these are American companies. We follow American, you know, we follow our laws, and the United States has Section 230. So technically they could be like, you know what, sorry about it. Content's staying up, you know, if it's offensive in your country, whatever. We can get into why there's some you know, concerns on that regard. But a lot of these internet services do not actually want to follow the American central view in that, you know, well, Section 230 protects us, so let's just keep it up. And there's a lot of important reasons why that is. It really depends on the service, and it depends on their messaging and their brand. So Twitter, for example, was it's a service that encourages open communication for all. And they were very, you know, I say were, they still are. They're very big on not removing content if it doesn't need to take down, because they want to encourage healthy conversations. They want to encourage people to put more content out there. You know, different companies though, maybe YouTube or, you know, just Google in general or, you know, other internet services, it'll depend on the content. And maybe that's not something that service wants displayed displayed out there. So it depends. The first thing they look at is it depends on the messaging. It depends on the content. It depends on the brand safety of the company. And those are, you know, some of the first things we kind of regard. But then the other thing that is important to look at is you've got, you know, you've got the Human Rights Council, and you've got stuff like the ICCPR that you can get guidance from. That's the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Those are, you know, we've got a very Americanized view of content that we deem important, and that's usually like your free speech related political conversations. Those are really important protected conversations, but there may be different emphasis placed on different types of content that preserve civil liberties and political rights that other countries value that, you know, we don't really think about. So we look to the ICCPR to get that guidance and to decide, well, is the American approach of leaving this up and, you know, regardless of what other countries think, is that the right move? Because if it's not, if we're in the minority for that type of content, then that's not probably the way that service wants to proceed. You know, and then there's other things that we think about, right? So Turkey is notorious for, you know, not having free content or free speech. They're not free speech friendly. And oftentimes a lot of takedown decisions, you can look at the public transparency reports for Google or Twitter or Facebook, you know, the big players, you'll see that a lot of the content requests to have content removed is from Turkey. So there's an internal discussion that has to take place as to whether, you know, what side does the company want to be on here? Do we want to continue promoting speech, or do we want to, you know, follow their laws and follow what their beliefs and their messaging and ban everything? And that's usually not the approach that these companies are willing to take. The important thing to think about too is, I feel like we always talk about whether content should, you know, stay up or whether it should come down. And there's other things that can be done to this type of content. There's decisions that can be made about like geo-targeting. If there's content that these countries, you know, are super offended by, or that there's kind of an agreement that it shouldn't be up there for that country or for that area, you can block it in that country, but leave it up in the United States or leave it up in other areas. And some people argue that that's causing what's called, you know, the splinternet or the splintering of the internet. But it's, in my opinion, it's always a lot better than removing it full scale. You know, if people can get around geo-targeting through VPNs, I think it's important that that content is still available. So again, I think it's really important for each piece of content that is being requested to be removed, for these services to have a thoughtful discussion about, you know, is this something that's shaping democracy? Are people's lives at stake? You think about like the Egyptian revolution, for example, a lot of that content, you know, it was really important that stayed up on Twitter. So it's a difficult question. It's really hard to draw lines, and it's something that these services have to be thoughtful about constantly.
Thank you very much. So I'd like to switch gears a little bit and ask you about misinformation. And that's an enormous concern on the internet. In recent weeks, for example, the social media companies have been working to take down false medical claims about purported but false cures for COVID-19. There's also a lot of concern about misinformation in relation to political campaigns, of course. Should addressing misinformation be handled organically through the market, or is there a legislative or regulatory role to play here?
I think there's a little bit of both. I am mostly for the market approach, though, just from what I've seen in general. It's one of the...
And by the way, when I say for the market, I meant, you know, the companies themselves responding to these claims acting as the market to sort of decide what to take down.
Right. Absolutely. Yes.
I wasn't suggesting that you should put out false medical claims and have, you know, have the consumers try to figure it out. I meant the market being the companies acting proactively, or should there be legislation forcing them to do so?
Right. Absolutely. So I'm torn on this one. I think there's a little bit of both. I will primarily vouch though for the market approach. That we've seen it working. And I think when we're talking about the internet and its nuances, the market approach is really the only option that makes sense, in my opinion. If we go from the regulatory approach, the first question I would want to ask is, what problem are you aiming to solve? Because, you know, let's just go down the line of health information or misinformation about, you know, even the coronavirus, COVID-19. There's already a lot of misinformation coming from so many different sources, even from our own government, because we don't understand this disease right now. You know, so how do we begin to draw a line or write a law that draws a line about what is misinformation when it comes to just the topic of the coronavirus, you know? And who should be allowed to put out that kind of information as well? I know that this is something that sites like YouTube are struggling with, where they're trying to figure out, well, you know, what content should be, what kind of health information content should be monetized. Some say like, oh, well, trusted news sources are a good approach, but then what is a trusted news source and which sources are to be trusted? And then again, if we don't know that much about the disease right now, how are we able to decide without several expert opinion or you know, other information, decide what really is misinformation versus what might actually be legitimate information? So I think when it comes to the internet, the problem with content moderation and content moderation at scale specifically is every time you try to draw boundaries on what is and isn't bad content or misinformation, bad actors are just going to make moves to expand those boundaries. So then Congress will have to then go back to the drawing board and expand boundaries again. It makes more sense for the market to be thinking about these things and for the market to approach it themselves, mainly because when you think about it, these internet services have, you know, their own intrinsic reasons as for being proactive, right? Again, everyone will say, well, you know, there's no reason for them to use the sword. They'll always use the shield of Section 230. Well, that's not quite true, because all of these services are out there for free. They have to make money somehow, and that's through their advertisers and through their users clicking on those advertisements. If you've got a site full of misinformation about, you know, health-related issues, or you've got a site that's even just jumbled with pornography or adult or awful content, you're not going to have users, and advertisers are not going to want to display their ads next to that kind of content. They're not going to be associated. So there's an intrinsic value to these services taking it upon themselves to regulate themselves, instead of the government handing down these mandates that may be unclear, or, you know, make the internet services jobs at moderating this content even harder than it needs to be.
Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears again and just talk briefly about artificial intelligence. Again, this is such a, you could talk, this is a whole, you know, topic of itself, but what are some of the ways that you think that AI can be used to improve the integrity and the efficiency of the information ecosystem? And what are some of the ways that it could be used to undermine information integrity?
Yeah, so, you know, AI, there's a lot of exploration and experimentation with automated content decision-making right now. We see that in mainly, you know, we've got that with YouTube's content ID for intellectual property issues. I know that they're using, some services are using AI to try to determine, you know, if something's a deep fake, or, you know, even just kind of using natural language processing, which is like a super basic way of determining if there are certain types of hate speech on your service, or just, you know, again, content that the service doesn't want to be associated with. So those are all excellent ways in which automated content decision making does its job. However, there are a lot of downsides to AI in this information integrity kind of space. Mainly for the reason that AI often gets things wrong. So, and that's kind of the concern here, is when they get it wrong and it results in important content being removed from the discussion, I almost argue that that is a worse outcome than the content staying up, depending on what the content is, right? So one example that always comes to mind is the famous Napalm Girl picture, from, you know, the Vietnam War. And this was a picture that was taken down by an automated content decision-making tool for nudity. And unfortunately, I mean, that picture, it's an incredibly historical and important piece of content that should, I believe, should be out there and be available. But automated content decision doesn't have that background or that necessary context to be able to make those kinds of decisions beyond, is this nudity or is this not nudity? And you see that a lot too in sort of these services that cater to really niche communities as well. We saw it with the transgender community at Twitter, where automated decision making didn't work in that regard because those kinds of communities have their own types of conversations that may be deemed inappropriate or you know, out there to other groups or unacceptable to other groups. But when you remove that speech, you're removing really, really important speech for that specific community that kind of empowers them and keeps them engaged on your service. So
those are really interesting points. Yeah.
It's difficult. AI is important. It's difficult to implement. And then you have all of your biases as well that come with implementing AI, because the people who program it, they've got their own human biases, and that comes through your technology as well.
Right. So one of the things that they're on the issue of, you know, deep fakes, which you briefly mentioned, which are, you know, videos or less commonly audio, but video generally that's been manipulated to make somebody appear to be doing or saying something that they never actually did or said. And there's been a lot of pressure on both state legislators and Congress to sort of do something about deepfakes, right? You know, pass legislation. And I guess the question is, you know, do you think new legislation is needed, or do you think we've got an ample set of existing legal frameworks that can be used to address the potential misuse of deepfakes?
Yeah, I think it's really important to recognize that when you're going after, you want to go after the right actors, right? So again, here it's not Facebook or Twitter or Google's their fault that in that regard that there's a deepfake out there on their service. You know, it's the person who put the deepfake out there. And so when we're talking about, is there already existing legal frameworks for going after the actor that put out the deepfake, there's tons of frameworks already available. You know, there's defamation. They've got rights to publicity, false endorsement, privacy, even intellectual property in some regard. So, I mean, the legal frameworks exist if you're targeting the right actor. I support the market over regulation here. And so I don't think, I mean, my same answer that I had for misinformation, I think it would be very difficult to sort of write up regulation that prevents against deepfakes, or that holds internet services liable for deepfakes, because again, the bad actors creating those deepfakes are just going to continue getting better. I mean, we know this from computer science. We know this from cybersecurity. Once you patch a security vulnerability, another one comes up that's even better. So we're seeing the same thing with deepfakes. Deepfakes are getting better. And then you've got to answer some other nuanced questions as well. Are some deepfakes, should they be allowed to stay on the service? There was one a couple of years ago that was done of Obama, and it was very clearly a parody. And it was, you know, people shared it, and they shared it as a parody, but should a service be required to remove that deepfake if it's a form of you know, entertainment or expression in that regard? You know, some would probably argue probably not. But yeah, how do you draw that line?
Of course, you can imagine
the
movie industry is going to be using deepfake techniques to make very legitimate biographies about, you know, for example, figures, people who lived in the past, and so on. So.
Right.
Okay. Well, just a last question I have is, I guess, just again on a question about Congress, but not about legislation. And one of the things that Congress does, of course, is legislate. But in addition to that, Congress can play a really important role in just educating and raising awareness. And what are some non-legislative ways that you'd like to see Congress get more engaged in sort of creating a healthier ecosystem, not involving new legislation?
Right. You know, I think we were talking a bit about this with the Earn It Act, the recent anti child exploitation material on the internet. It's an act that's kind of coming down the pipeline that would very much be a detriment to Section 230. And we had discussions. You know, it's interesting that when you dig into Congress's investigations. There's a lot of unopened or uninvestigated child pornography reports that these entities that would do those investigations within the DOJ just don't have the resources for. And so we question, you know, if you were going to, you know, remove if going after the internet service, removing Section 230, threatening them to do better, if the necessary resources aren't being, I guess, directed towards the groups that would be able to hold these bad actors accountable, then what's the point? I mean, it's not going to end with the internet service. So I think there's a lot of value in placing resources into the right places within our regulators. So, you know, opening investigations, for example, that was something that really hurt Backpage back during the sex trafficking and FOSTA, I guess, issue. So actually investigating.
Right, I guess just for context, my understanding is what happened was, you know, FOSTA SESTA, of course, was designed to combat sex trafficking, but one of the unintended consequences was that it took down the sites that sex workers were using to exchange information with one another about dangerous clients. And so so it ended up having this very detrimental side effect to what was on its face certainly a noble goal of you know, nobody would argue with the goal of combating sex trafficking. It's just that the solution ended up creating this collateral damage for you know, creating a new set of people who were then, you know, hurt by the legislation, unintended consequences.
Right, absolutely. But you know, the threat of investigating is, you know, one way in which without regulating, Congress can maybe push the needle or push these companies to take a closer look at what's going on their services when it comes to, you know, sex trafficking or again, other harmful content, like harmful content for children. They've got other tools as well. They can threaten litigation. They can even shame these companies. You see that a lot. If they think that the companies are not, you know, working diligently to prevent against harmful conduct or content, then that can be made a lot clearer than handing down regulation. They can even promote guidelines. I mean, the FTC has ways in which they can promote guidelines for how services might or might not conduct their moderation practices. But again, these shouldn't be guidelines that they should be held to. They should just simply be bad guidelines.
These are more sort of soft law approaches to doing some of these things.
Right, right. And then, I mean, the last thing would be personally something I would like to see is dedicating resources towards promoting technology and internet education. So especially in our schools, I've always said that, you know, even just basically knowing how to program, that should be like basic math in our school systems. But, you know, we're not teaching kids to code. I don't think we're having the necessary conversations about how to verify and how to validate information that you run into on the internet. You know, there's multiple sources that you can check. And I think that really, really needs to be a bigger conversation in our school system so that we can kind of train the next generation of internet users to be a lot more vigilant against this kind of content.
Now that's a great point. And, you know, one of the challenges, of course, is curricula evolve over, you know, years and decades, but, you know, the technology for, you know, infrastructure evolves over months, right? So, all right, well, I can't thank you enough for offering your perspectives on this. And, you know, thanks very much. And we will get it posted.
Absolutely.